Accession number 28424, reel number 1.
Reverend Hans, reel 1. Could you tell me where and when you were born, please?
Woodford Green in Essex, 1931, November 4.
And what did your father do for a living?
He was a Lloyds Bank head office man for most of his working life in the city.
Had he seen any military service in the First World War, or had any members of your family seen military service?
He had in the Middle East, and his younger brother in France, who was killed in 1917.
What had your father served with? Was there a...
Pass. I don't know.
What about the area? What was Woodward Green like while you were growing up?
It was a London suburb, a dormitory. The people around us marched down to the station every morning and marched back again in the evening, much as they still do today, I imagine. The house we lived in was typical of many built in the late 20s, early 30s, I would say.
What about your education?
Secondary education, primary education first, I suppose, in Woodford Green at a kindergarten sort of school. The war then intervened, and my family were moved out of London to Stratford-on-Avon, where my father had family connections. So I spent the war years in Shakespeare School, the grammar school there, and immediately at the end of the war went for the next 5 years to Hurstpool Point in Sussex, a school of the Woodard Foundation. And then ultimately to Oxford, but national service came in between.
During your education and during the wartime, were there any memories of any incidents that occurred during the Second World War as you were growing up?
Yes, indeed, one particularly horrible one. Because Stratford was sort of on the air route to Coventry in the Midlands, night after night we spent under the stairs. But there were no incidents that affected us, except one day a training aircraft, Royal Air Force training aircraft, crashed literally in front of the house, killing the pilot, and that was a most dramatic and unpleasant experience for a pre-teenager.
When you finish your secondary education, mm-hmm. Was it at that point that you were notified that you would have to do national service?
Oh, everybody knew it was. There were 2 years to be taken out of your life, mostly after school and before any further training. Though some opted to do it the other way around. You grew up, I suppose, right from the start, knowing. I forget exactly the dates when it came in, but I suppose 47, 48, the requirement, as you know, was to replace the huge numbers of soldiers and servicemen generally who had been released at the end of the war, or were released later on, many of them becoming reservists, many of them being recalled, for example, in Korea in 51. So there was a huge manpower problem, and we all knew that this was going to happen, and it did.
Did you have to register, or were you already registered as soldier?
It was an automatic process.
Now, you said you were obviously going on to Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
At that stage, could you have deferred your national service until you completed your education?
Yes, you could, but this depended, A, on the educational establishment and what their requirements were. And I think the majority of my contemporaries felt that they wanted to get the the service behind them before they completed the educational process and went on to begin their careers, rather than have the education completed and then be on hold for 2 years whilst the service had to be completed. So I think that was the most popular way round.
And what about your own thoughts at that time? Were you looking forward to it, or was it just something that you had to do?
It was something that you had to do. Everybody around you before you did it, 9 out of 10 in the army, because the other services couldn't really train you sufficiently quickly to make any use of you, certainly not in the Royal Navy, and certainly not in the Air Force if you wish to be a pilot, for example. There just wasn't time.
And obviously society slightly changed since those times, in the sense that there is no national service and that people joined the regular army. Was mm-hmm. there more of a culture of understanding military service with the war being so recent and everybody going into national service?
Yes, I think we all felt we were part of a sort of ongoing tradition. Yes, all of us at my age at that time had been, as you rightly say, had grown up as children and teenagers during the war years. It was part of our life, part of our culture, as you say. Yeah.
How were you notified of your service, and was there an element when you were notified of knowing where you were going?
Well, I suppose the War Office sent me a letter and told me to report to Miani Barracks, Colchester, in September 1950. So I did. Otherwise, facing I don't know what. It was all a very straightforward process.
And on arrival, how were you kind of met at the barracks?
Memories get a bit faint. Everybody would tell you the same thing, that the first memory was the injection program, which left everybody prostrate for about 36 hours. I forget now which particular bug you were injected against, but it knocked everybody sideways. So that was the first thing. And once you got over that, well, it was into uniform and square bashing and the usual basic training routine.
What type of uniforms were you issued with at that stage?
Battle dress.
With the issue of the battle dress, a lot of people mentioned that the initial battle dress that they got didn't fit very well. Did you have to make amendments or swap equipment with other people?
No, I don't recall. I do remember a very early parade and being addressed by a National Service officer who was shortly due to stand down, and he was extremely anxious about the size of our shirts and whether or not our collars fitted and we could do our ties up. Once this was over, that was the end of the story, and you just got on with it in the kit you were provided with.
And at this stage, were you a private? Had there been any notion that you would go in as an officer, or was that a later thing that was told?
No, it was a selection process. Again, well established, everybody knew what to expect. There was a local selection process in the unit from whence you were recommended for a national selection process, which entailed going somewhere in Salisbury Plain, you may be sure. I think it was called Barton Stacey, where you underwent all the usual sort of tests of leadership ability, like carrying oil drums across rivers without the necessary equipment and that sort of thing. And if you were successful in that, you then were posted to one of the officer cadet training schools, in my case Eaton Hall in Cheshire.
Did that process occur, though, after your basic training?
Yes. I think the basic training was 10 weeks, roughly speaking. Took one from September when I joined to Christmas, so I went to Eaton Hall in January, don't I remember, in January 1951.
Can I just add a little bit about the basic training at that period? How much emphasis was placed on drill at that stage?
Initially, an awful lot. Square bashing was the order of the day.
And who would you instruct you in that?
Four rank corporals, a sergeant who was in charge of each draft. And then I think, I can't really remember the timing of it, but things then did broaden out a little into very basic weapon training and field craft and so on.
The getting used to the kind of drill, did you adjust to that quite quickly? Had you done any...
Oh, well, I'd done years in the school cadet course, so none of it came as any surprise to me.
Was that the same for everybody? Did they all...
No, by no means. Well, I should imagine a large majority of people had never been away from home and certainly never worn uniform or done any military training. For me it was routine, well established, but for others it must have been quite a shock, I guess, to begin with.
You say that some people had not been away from home. Did some of the recruits take badly to that at the time?
Initially, I think, yes, particularly because of this first miserable weekend. I mean, he couldn't have asked for a more graphic and unpleasant introduction to military life.
Had it helped, all that experience you had? Did that make you just quicker, would you say?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. There was nothing new, really. Just a different roof.
Actually, that's interesting. Could I ask you about accommodation while you were there? What kind of room?
Oh, typical pre-war barrack building. I don't know, 30 beds to a room, maybe. Corporal sleeping at the end in a small private cubicle. Enders kit inspections. I think everybody experienced much the same sort of conditions.
With the kit inspections, when would they take place?
Interminably. it was part of the knuckling down process. It was part of them getting on top of you, which in turn meant that you emerged in the army thinking anyway as a better and better soldier.
Would you have to do a lot of preparation for a kit inspection?
Oh, endless. Polishing and arranging and so on. Very boring.
And would there be any penalties if the room wasn't...
Yes, there were, but I can't remember how these were. I can't remember, but certainly, yes, if things didn't come up to standard, there were... the best could happen is you went round again, but I'm sure there were worse things than that.
Who were the inspections carried out by?
Oh, by the draft officer.
Would you have much contact with officers at that stage, or would it really be...
No, very little. Very little, initially, because of the parade ground work. But that came in more and more with the more, slightly more sophisticated part of the training programme.
And how were relations at this stage with the NCOs and, the junior officers? I know you mentioned that you had a few... Little contact.
Oh, reasonable enough, provided you did what you were told to do and did it as well as you could. There was no great problem.
Because obviously today there are a number of sort of allegations about bullying. Was that really the case?
I was totally unaware of it as far as I was concerned and as far as I witnessed. I nothing of that at all.
You mentioned you did some basic weapons training. What kind of level was that to?
Well, we were still using the Lee Enfield rifle, so there would have been an introductory course to the use and cleaning of that weapon. There would have been some range firing and introduction and practice with hand grenades also. I think that's about as far as it went.
And again, had your experience, had you done...
Well, no, we did the drill and that weapon training, but no firing, no. Though at school there was actually a shooting team, but that was unrelated to the cadet corps.
So in January 1951, you arrive at Eton Hall.
Yes.
Having been selected. Can you tell me a little bit about the selection process? What type of things you think they were looking for in potential National Service officers?
Oh dear me, it sounds very pompous, but leadership. But it does sound very pompous saying that in cold blood, but and what it means and how you define it, I have no idea.
Can you remember any of the types of questions that they were asking at that period, really, during the selection process? What they may have been trying to say?
No, not really. As I say, there were the impossible physical tasks which you had to undertake or try and undertake. Interviews, just trying to find out what sort of person you were and whether you were appropriate and suitable for commission status.
You mentioned the physical tasks. Was there a lot of emphasis placed on good physical fitness?
Oh, yes. And, of course, in those sort of drills, teamwork, again, they wanted to know if you were a good team player.
So once selected, how did the process at Eton Hall, how did that map itself out?
Well, that went much, much deeper into all aspects of army life. Yes, there was a strong parade ground element, daily full parade of the entire school, under the legendary Regimental Sergeant Major Kopp. But then it broke out down into lectures and training skills of one sort or another, culminating in a battle camp, Okehampton, for a week or 10 days, in which a lot of action activities were simulated, and that the whole process took 16 weeks, as I recall.
Within that process, you mentioned the battle camp. What type of things were you doing at the battle camp that had differed from, obviously, previous training?
You mentioned physical fitness. Well, the highlight, if you were that way inclined, was a nine mile bash, as it was called, in full kit. I forget what time you had to achieve that in, and you did it as a group. It wasn't an individual thing. That was pretty much horrific, I do recall. No, there were it was a lot of practical work in the open, how to be a soldier in attack and defence, all of which I hasten to add had absolutely no bearing on subsequent activities in the jungle.
What type of tactics were they teaching you? Was it based really on a kind of North German plane scenario rather than
Yes, that is a very good description. The basis of it was fire and movement, and anyone who served, roughly speaking, at the same time that I did would know exactly what is meant by that. It meant in attack you had a static group and a moving group, and those roles were reversed, and so you had a ongoing leapfrog fire movement.
What about defence? What kind of tactics were you taught for defence?
I don't know that we were, come to think of it. No, I have no recollection. I think we were offensive rather than defensive.
Was emphasis placed on things like map reading and navigation, that sort of thing?
Well, it must have been. The wide open spaces of the moor were, of course, ideal for that. Excuse me. But I have no distinct memory of those sort of activities.
You mentioned slightly that it wasn't of much use to you, obviously, in the jungle.
No.
Was there much of that training that you that you found useful, or did you, in a sense...
No, it was a completely different theatre of war. War. I shouldn't use the word war. Perhaps I should digress at this point, because obviously we're going to be talking about Malaya. We were not at war. We were serving in aid of the civil power. But yes, the entire topographical and climatic situation was so vastly different from anything you could experience in the UK, that the rules were very, very local.
Once you'd finished the course, was there a commissioning ceremony at that stage? Were you an officer at that point, or were you then appointed to a regiment? How did that work?
I don't recall any ceremony. There must have been a communication from the War Office, and yes, indeed, one was posted. At that time, as an officer cadet, I was wearing the badge of the Essex Regiment, because that was my home regiment with whom I trained, and I was commissioned into 1 Suffolk and told to report to Bury St Edmunds, which was the regimental headquarters.
At that stage, had you anticipated, obviously doing your national service, that you may actually see active service?
It was a lottery. One had no idea. You could have spent the next 18 months in Bury St Edmunds, or more likely in Germany, with BAOR. But the theatres of activity were, at that time, certainly Malaya, and then Korea, which became extremely significant in this manpower problem. And as you know, the Commonwealth Brigade played a very significant role, and a lot of my friends and contemporaries served there.
When you arrived at the depot, were you given any specific duties?
No, none. I was there simply to get on the train, and hence the boat, and go to Singapore. I undertook no regimental duties at Bury's at all, other than, of course, those required a junior officer for the few days that I was there. No, we were a very, very large draft of 80-odd. Happily for me, as a very junior and inexperienced officer, I had, I think, 6 full-rank regular corporals to help sort things out. And memorable journey that was. So we marched to Bury St Edmunds Station. We got on the train. We got to Liverpool Street. And as instructed, I reported to the RTO. Oh, yes, he said. 80 of you. Well, I'm sorry, but we've only got 1 3-tonner, which will just about take your kit. The rest of your draft will have to go by underground. Well, you can imagine my reaction. Here were 80 young men, many of whom probably had never been in London before, and they had to be got from Liverpool Street to Waterloo, which is where the 6 full-rank corporals came in, because we divided up into groups. And I'm happy to say that all arrived at Waterloo and got on the train to Southampton. So that, and I was the one who rode in front of 3-tonner with the kit. And again, a remarkable memory of going across Waterloo Bridge in June 51, when the South Bank Festival Hall and all that was sort of just happening. It was something I will never forget, I must say. So then what? Oh, well, yes, Waterloo, Southampton, and the Empire Windrush. 4 weeks later, Singapore.
What were conditions like aboard the Empire Windrush?
for me, on the way out, A deck. A double cabin shared with a Royal West Kent officer. The Empire Windrush, I do not know her original name, but she had been rescued from the bottom of Bremen Harbour. She had been a pre-war German cruise ship. I can't imagine that life in a hammock on D deck was terribly enjoyable.
And at that stage, while you were on the boat, did you use that as an opportunity to get to know the members of the draft, or was that not really what?
No, not really, because you didn't know. You didn't know what. To begin with, apart from the regulars I mentioned who were going back for a second tour, nobody had the faintest idea. And there were no facilities really for training anyway, in a relatively confined space of a medium-sized ship. So, no, there was very little military activity.
Which route kind of did you take at that stage with the Empire Windrush? Did it go through the Mediterranean and down?
Yes, the Suez Canal stops at Aden and Colombo, as I recall.
And what happened on arrival at Singapore?
We had been joined by a senior officer in the regiment at one of those stops. And he in turn, of course, had contacts within the regiment on the staff. We were met by a fellow officer and taken to a mess, I think for 24 hours, and then trained to Kuala Lumpur.
At that stage, was there a threat to the trains?
Yes. Yes. It was a very... very popular form of terrorist activity.
Were any precautions taken on the train journey?
Yeah, well, they were, again, not by us, because we weren't armed. But, yes, there would have been someone in command of the train, militarily speaking, and there would have been protection, either military or police, on board.
Was that a kind of overt thing, or was it something that you didn't really notice as you got on the train?
Probably the first time round one didn't notice it, no. But we, of course, were briefed that this situation did apply, and I suppose one was aware of whatever branch of the service was in charge.
And obviously arriving at this time, what kind of knowledge did you have of the situation in Malaya?
Oh, because of the history of the regiment, a very good knowledge overall, I would say. One understood the situation. What you couldn't get your head round was the actual physical circumstances until you encountered them.
Had you received sort of briefings then of the situation,
oh, yes.
What the regiment was up to at
yes,
that time?
Yes, yes, oh yes, yes. We knew the history, and we knew the locations in which the regiment operated. We knew as much as we could as background, but what you could not anticipate was what you were actually going to be doing and what it would be like to be doing it.
And how long had the regiment been out there?
Oh, I think over 2 years at the time I arrived.
So were they relatively experienced
within
the conditions?
Yes, they were, and had a very high repute.